If you're a fan of big ideas, debate, and politics, check out our festival partner, geopolitical magazine, Foreign Policy. A forum for informed debate about global affairs, Foreign Policy keeps a finger on the pulse of world news and political happenings. Beyond articles that delve behind the headlines via traditional reporting, Foreign Policy has so many other products to offer, ensuring that no matter how you like to engage with eye-opening content, there is a method for you. Check out their free offerings, like Foreign Policy Live, their forum for live journalism, newsletters, and podcasts. And with a subscription, unlock in-depth features and quarterly magazines, including their recently dropped spring edition, All About India. Fans of IAI will love Foreign Policy for more of the mind-expanding, insightful content that they seek. To explore their content, take advantage of an exclusive discount for IAI fans. Subscribe now using promo code LIGHT24 to save 50% and unlock access to everything Foreign Policy has to offer.
Today we've got Why We Should Question Everything, an interview with Michael Della Rocca. It took place at our London How the Light Gets In Festival in 2023. This is the philosophy festival produced twice a year by the team here at the IAI. So, Margarita, what did you think about this interview?
I thought it was a really good interview. Michael Della Rocca has a really interesting theory that builds on Spinoza and really unpacks how language is essentially a relata, what he defines as like an infinite set of relations that describes reality. It's quite innovative and I would say quite radical. So a great interview if you're interested in Quine or Saussure or indeed language.
Great. Before we hand over to Simon, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review on your platform of choice, and visit IAI.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
A lot of philosophers today really are subservient to common sense and to our intuitions. And those are different things, perhaps, but for our purposes, they're pretty much the same, that people feel that we must respect common sense beliefs, we must respect our intuitions, and a philosophical system has to try to accommodate intuitions as much as possible, try to accommodate common sense as much as possible. But I think that's kind of really a bankrupt methodology. I think that in terms of how one should do philosophy, if one is really being guided only by one's intuitions or by common sense, then one is not really doing one's job as a philosopher, because this is the methodology of relying on intuitions or common sense is inherently conservative, I think. It's also too much guided by our psychology, and it's ultimately arbitrary. And so I think it's really not a great way to do philosophy.
You know, that may be true, that, you know, we're guided in our psychology, and maybe our psychology sort of twist our perception of reality. But, you know, ultimately, we want to get at truth, and philosophy wants to get at truth. So is there a reason to think that you've criticized this view for being unduly conservative, but maybe the conservative tracks the truth in a way that this sort of radical methodology does not?
Maybe so, right? But I think that this kind of, we don't know in advance what's going to track the truth, and we shouldn't constrain ourselves from the very beginning, which this methodology of common sense relies upon. And so really, I'm going to go against a lot of common sense views and do so, I think, because I think there's a good reason to do so. I think that should be the methodology that philosophy should be guided for, to follow the reasons where they lead. And even if those reasons lead to a place that's far from common sense. Philosophy is nothing if not has potential to be radical. And I think that that's a kind of a birthright for philosophy, that it should at least be open to kinds of radical changes in views. And I think this is largely true of contemporary and recent analytical philosophy. It's really extremely conservative, and it really is going to be too much guided by common sense and never really will get to these kinds of radical results, which are, at least should be a possibility that philosophers should not forswear at the beginning.
So tell me more about these radical results. In the book, you call it this sort of radical monism. Can you explain sort of the view more in detail?
So this kind of radical monism is the view that there are no distinctions. And that's what I mean by monism. There are no distinctions. And I get to that view because I think that there is no way to explain relations of distinction. In general, for me, relations are not explicable. This comes out of an explanatory demand, which I think is very natural In the case of relations, we do think, I think, even the ordinary view of my opponents is that relations must be explained. They're explained, relations are explained in terms of the things that are related. Relations are grounded in their relata. And so if there's going to be a relation, it has to be explained by, it has to be grounded in its relata. And I use that kind of explanatory demand to show that those kinds of the explanations themselves are not forthcoming, that relations cannot be explained. And so because it's an explanatory demand, for relations to be real, they must be explained. Because they can't be explained, it turns out that relations are not real. And thus, in particular, relations of distinction between one thing and another are not real. And so we quickly get to the view that there are no distinctions at all.
Yeah, you draw this link between, you know, there's an explanatory demand and the relation needs to be explained for it to be real. You know, why is that the case? Can you tell me more about what's driving that?
So yeah. I think that in general, what's behind that is a general version of what philosophers call the principle of sufficient reason. For each fact, there's a sufficient reason for that fact. There's an explanation for that fact. So there's this explanatory demand in general holds, but in order to generate this argument for the lack of distinctions, I don't need a full-blown commitment to the principle of sufficient reason. All that I need is just the intuitive claim that relations must be grounded, relations have to be explained. Even if facts in general don't have to be explained, relations have to be explained. There cannot be, as they put it, free-floating relations. Relations are just not hovering there. They have to be grounded in something that makes them real, if they're going to be real at all.
Yeah, and can we, you know, make this more concrete and give an example? So, you know, a relation might be like the friendship between you and me. You know, and what about that is on? So you're saying that the relationship of friendship is grounded by you and me, right? The relation of friendship doesn't exist in the abstract.
Yes. So okay. there's a relation between you and me. Okay.
Yeah.
You exist. Let's say assume. I exist, let's say, and there's a relation between us. That relation, or that relational fact, must be grounded in you and me, but it's also, and must be explained in that way, but it also must be explained in terms of the part, another relation. So that this relation between you and me, and it's grounded in, it stands in a grounding relation to you, and it stands in a grounding relation to me. So that relation between you and me is grounded not only in you, not only in me, but also in the relation of grounding between you and the relation. And that relation is itself in need of being grounded, and that's going to generate another relation, and so on. So there'll be an infinite regress of relations once you try to explain any given relation. So that kind of regress of relations is what's called Bradley's regress in some version, and I have another version of that regress in my book. That kind of infinite regress of relations is vicious, and so it precludes it from being the case that any given relations is explained. And also, there's also if you don't like the vicious regress, there's also vicious circularity here. Whenever we get into the business of trying to explain relations, we quickly get into these regresses or these circles that undermine any hope of explanation.
Right. So. If we really follow this view to where it leads, it's this really radical view where distinctions and differentiation are unreal, and all that there is just undifferentiated being. If we apply that to language, it would mean that the words that we're saying right now don't have differentiated, distinct meanings.
That's right.
How is it that we're able to communicate right now and understand each other intelligibly?
We seem to be communicating right now, right? So, and that's a wonderful thing. But on this view, meanings are individuated. The typical view is that there are distinct nuggets of meaning in language, and given each word has its own chunk of meaning, another word has its own meaning, etc. And these are distinct from one another. But if relations in general are unintelligible, then I apply this in the case of philosophy of language, and so individuated meanings are unintelligible as well. Right. So this comes up in a view of the American philosopher, great philosopher Quine, has this view, this kind of radical holist view, that according to him, there are no determinate meanings. No word has a determinate meaning all its own, given the holism of meaning. And I want to take that holism even more generally and say there's no determinate meanings. If there's going to be meaning at all, meaning resides in the whole of language, not in any discrete individual linguistic items. So I'm not denying that there's meaning, but meaning is not in individual words. Rather, meaning is in language as a whole. Just as I'm not denying in terms of the topic of being, that there is being, but what I'm denying is a distinction among individual beings, just as I'm denying in philosophy of language, a distinction between the meanings of individual words.
In your own words in the book, you say philosophy is in the business of explaining things, right? And so it seems like language does have distinct meanings. You know, isn't that something that needs to be explained in the view? You know, this picture of seeing language as undifferentiated. On that view, it's hard to understand how it is that we're having an intelligible conversation.
Right. So two things here. One is that I think that, again, it does seem that we're communicating in some sense with using individuated meanings. But that's a verdict of common sense and relying on the method of intuitions there. So again, I began by saying that I'm not going to be bound by this method of common sense or method of intuitions because it's far too conservative for philosophy. So you're quite right in a way to bring up the fact, hey, it seems that we're communicating. That's just another intuition that you have, and we have to question that and see where it leads. And the other thing to mention here is that my view is ultimately going to be a skeptical view. I'm denying the coherence of the concept of individuated meanings. I'm denying the coherence of the concept of distinction. So that these are ordinary concepts to which you're very much committed, but it's a skeptical view that I'm proposing here in this vein.
Yeah, and I was just going to ask you, to what extent is your view really a skepticism about philosophy or the possibility of doing philosophy rather than, you know, a positive metaphysical conclusion about reality, sort of oneness or wholeness? On the one hand, you say, you know, philosophers are obligated to try to explain everything. But again, you're also saying that this is futile in some sense and that explanation sort of, you know, doesn't really work in the end. So, you know, Michael, is philosophy impossible?
Well, it's a great question. And it's my job, right? I get money to pay to be a philosopher, but I may be philosophy myself out of business here if philosophy is not possible. And I think the question, the skepticism here is a skepticism about the possibility of doing philosophy. To the extent that philosophy depends upon relations of distinction, which are unintelligible, it may not be possible to do philosophy. So that's a view that I think that we always have to keep that possibility alive here, because it may not be possible to do philosophy in the terms in which ordinary thinking can be done. If that presupposes distinctions, if that presupposes individuated nuggets of meaning which are unintelligible.
Right. And so you know, going forward, you know, we've been talking a lot about the nature of reality and metaphysics and what sort of, you know, basic ontologies, right? But, you know, just switching gears here to seeing how the view applies to ethics and morality, it really seems like you need differentiated meaning to make sense of that. You know, there's a difference between, you know, right and wrong, and in between you and me, and different sort of ethical, you know, or moral agents. So how does the view work for morality and ethics? It seems like it's just self-undermining on its face.
This is a great challenge. And this is why in the book, the Permanentian Ascent book, I didn't directly discuss topics of ethics because I knew that would be the most controversial part of it. And that's what I'm working on now, to try to extend the view into ethics. So what are the implications for my view, my radical monist view, there are no distinctions for ethics? I think the implications are considerable. If there's a normative, non-normative distinction, which is really what most of moral philosophy depends on, I'm rejecting the normative, non-normative distinction. That doesn't mean that I'm rejecting a notion of goodness. I'm rejecting all kinds of notions, moral notions that involve negativity or relations. If there's a non-relational notion of goodness, that can be maintained. What cannot be maintained is the ordinary structure that you find in Kantian moral philosophy and other forms of moral philosophy, structure of duties and obligations and rights. All those things ultimately don't make sense, because rights and duties and obligations are all specified in terms of what one must not do. And so it presupposes distinctions, and that cannot be made intelligible. But there can be a purely positive notion of goodness. That is what remains. And that can be what remains of an ethical philosophy on this view, according to which there is no normative, non-normative distinction.
Right. So, you know, many philosophers nowadays, to make this even more concrete, especially those working in metaphysics and analytic tradition, don't see any implications for the research or for how they live their lives. Is this a mistake that betrays sort of philosophy's origins and its love of wisdom? And are there any lessons that you've drawn from your own research that inform how you live your life?
This is a question I get a lot because I started out as a philosopher for many years, just doing things in my ivory tower way in studying history of philosophy. And I love history of philosophy. I still do history of philosophy, but doing pure metaphysics without regard to one's life. But once I started applying these kinds of radical rationalist arguments to lead to a monistic conclusion, I saw that these views did have applications for how one lives one's life, especially now that I'm going into the moral implications of the view. So yes, I think philosophy's calling in its origins is based on the question, how should one live one's life? And that I think is something that these kinds of metaphysical views leading to undermining of distinctions can have implications for how one lives one's life, because one has to embrace the goodness, as it were, and deny negativity.
Do you think morality is more important than metaphysics in the end of the day?
I think there's no difference between morality and metaphysics. That's what it has to be. There's no difference between morality and metaphysics. So I think that philosophers who try to work just in metaphysics and not do moral philosophy, that's sort of just a misguided point of view.
Right. In the end of the day, this view is, you have this non-relational notion of being, and goodness is a part of that. So it really, we're getting into sort of mystical territory. I mean, how do you see yourself in that sort of mystical tradition that begins with Parmenides?
I've made my peace with that. Yes. I used to resist the label of mysticism. But I'll tell you a story. I gave a talk once, and a lot of these radical views, and someone came up to me once and said, how does your view differ from mysticism? And I said, it doesn't. And I think that's now I've embraced it. And I think one of the things that's really interesting is that I've started out, I am a rationalist, I'm committed to the principle of sufficient reason. Everything has an explanation. But if you take that principle to its extreme, I think you wind up in a territory that's mystical territory. And you might think that mysticism is incompatible with the principle of sufficient reason, but I think it's not. I think that if you take this commitment to reason and rationality to its extreme, then you're led to this kind of mystical view where the distinctions among things collapses, the distinction among concepts collapses. And so this mystical view is one that cannot be articulated in language, which as long as that language involves distinctions. So this view cannot be articulated in language, but it's something I got to, this kind of non-conceptual view of reality, as it were, through a kind of rational argumentation.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Philosophy for Our Times. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review on your platform of choice, and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. Thanks for listening.